Well, this evening I want to talk about water. Cool, cool water. So keep your eye on that tariff and that glass of water. We have three things to say, 3 points. And point number one, we'll call Give Me a Drink. So please come with me to the reading which we had, John chapter 4, where beside Jacob's well, a thirsty Jesus meets with a Samaritan woman. They're alone. John tells us that Jesus' disciples have gone into the city, the local town, to buy food. So let's eavesdrop on their conversation. Cool, cool water. So verse 7. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Her reply is terse. Verse 9. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" And then John adds, "For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." It's an unpromising start, isn't it? Everything's against this conversation going any further. Jesus is a Jew, she's a Samaritan. And as John says, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans, except, of course, to trade insults. There was a sectarian divide. Jews hated Samaritans, Samaritans hated Jews. But not only is Jesus a Jew and she a Samaritan, Jesus is a man and she's a woman. Do you know what that means? Well, the disciples certainly did. When they return to find Jesus has been talking with this woman, they're shocked. Verse 27, at this point, his disciples came and they marveled, they're astonished that he talked with, what, a woman? And yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" In that culture, in that society, alone talking with a woman is something you just did not do. In fact, some Jews didn't even talk to their wives in public. So Jesus is reaching across every divide to engage with this woman. He breaks the rules. He won't be put off. He comes as a friend. So he ignores her unfriendliness and he keeps the conversation going, verse 10. Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Cool, cool water. Jesus turns the whole thing on its head. Instead of me asking you for a drink, you should have been asking me for a drink, and I would have given to you living water. Jesus' words are irresistible. If I said, "In that room there's a gift for you, the gift in that room is wonderful, unique, there's nothing like it in the world, it's the answer to all your hopes and fears," wouldn't you be the tiniest, tiniest bit interested to find out what it was? Well, says Jesus, this is a gift from God. Given by, well, who is this Jesus? And living water. There they are by a well, in a dry, dusty place. And he's speaking about living water. And now her whole attitude changes. Verse 11. The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?" You're obviously not talking about the water that's to be found in this well. So where do you get this living water? And who are you? Verse 12, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" Look at Jesus' reply, verse 13. "Whoever drinks of this water," pointing to the well, "will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." Did you hear that? "Drink this water," says Jesus, "and you'll thirst again. You'll have to keep coming back every day backwards and forwards, coming back for more water. You'll spend your whole short life returning to this place for water, because this water will leave you thirsty again and again and again. But the water that I shall give will satisfy your thirst forever. The water that I give will never run dry. It will fill your emptiness to overflowing. For the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water, springing up into everlasting life. My friend, in the heat and dust of this world, Jesus promises cool, cool water. But if you want it, says Jesus, you must come to me to get it. Whoever drinks of this water, but whoever drinks the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But once you've gone to him, once you've drunk the water that he gives, you'll never look anywhere else. The search is over. The thirst is gone. Jesus gives abundant satisfaction. So why go anywhere else? As I've sometimes said to the children in the past, coming to Jesus is like drinking an everlasting cool glass of water on a hot, dry day. Jesus satisfies the soul to overflowing. Cool, cool water. But the conversation moves on. Verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." Jesus is now talking her language. Her heart is a desert, and Jesus is offering her living water. So she says, "Well, give me this water." But then another thought kicks in. This could all be one big wind-up. This could just be another man promising the earth. So in case she's sounding a bit too keen, she adds in, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." You know, even if this living water isn't all this cracked up to be, at least it'll make my life a bit easier. Yes? If that's where you fit. You think all this Jesus stuff? Maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be, but, you know, just coming on a Sunday, I somehow feel a bit better. It makes life a bit easier. Well, now the conversation takes an unexpected turn. Verse 16. Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." You want this living water? Then go and fetch your husband and together come to me. But Jesus touches a raw nerve. Look at her reply. Verse 17, she says, "I have no husband." We've all been in those conversations, haven't we? She's been relaxed, she's been talking freely, and now suddenly she clams up. In the original language, her reply is just three words. Jesus has touched a raw nerve. So what's the problem? She has a personal history. She doesn't want to talk about it. There are things in her life that she doesn't want him to know about. So Jesus tears off the mask. Verse 17, "You have well said, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly." She's gone from relationship to relationship to relationship. She's gone to one man after another. Five husbands, and this time she's not even bothered to get married. So she's not okay, is she? And you see, this living water is pure, clean, new. And as it washes through my life, it makes me pure, clean, new. So if this woman is to take this living water, it will mean changes. Changes which the water will bring about. A dirty life will be made clean. My friend, cool, cool water. Are you thirsty? Would you come to Jesus for a drink? Would you let Jesus touch your raw nerve? Well, put on the spot, what does this woman do? She does what many of us do. She changes the subject. I have a friend, and we can talk together about his Sunday school days. We can talk about church. We can even, at a push, talk about God. But as soon as the name of Jesus enters the conversation, he's a master of changing the subject. I don't know how it happens. We're there, and then suddenly we've gone over here. You know, it's like one of those sort of quick change artists. You know, they're wearing a red dress, and then they sort of go behind a screen, and they come out wearing a blue dress. Changes the subject. So what does our woman say? Verse 19. The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." She changes the subject. She raises a theological red herring. We never realized, did we? She was so interested in theology. But Jesus, he runs with it. Verse 21. "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." Yes, these old arguments between Jews and Samaritans, they're fast becoming obsolete. Because it's not a question of worshipping God in the right place and in the right, doing the right thing in the right place. You know, this mountain or in Jerusalem. It's not about going to church and keeping the rules. It's about a right relationship with God. Not about religion, but reality. "Now it's true," says Jesus, verse 22, "that the Jews have a closer understanding of that than anyone else. Salvation is of the Jews. But what matters now," verse 23, "is a right-hearted relationship with God." In other words, my life, my loves, my identity is to be centered upon God, upon him above and beyond all other things. Then he sort of sums it up, verse 24. "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." In other words, says Jesus, what is to give my existence meaning is God. My life is to be centered on God. I am to worship God himself. No substitutes, only the real thing. And you see, in different words, Jesus has brought her back to cool, cool water. Back to the real thing. Back to the God who alone satisfies the soul. To know him, to love him, to enjoy him, to worship him. To give to him my whole being. To worship God and find in him my all in all. And of course, Jesus' words are an open invitation to us all to come and discover this relationship, this living water, for ourselves. Because he says, verse 23, "For the Father is seeking such to worship him." Well, verse 25. "The woman said to him, 'I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things.'" And Jesus, having brought her thus far, changed round the whole conversation from such an unpromising start. He now reveals who he is. Verse 26. Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." It's an electrifying moment, isn't it? She now knows that this ordinary-looking Jew, sitting beside Jacob's well, is in fact Messiah. The one we've all been waiting for. The one who comes from God to bring us back to God. Everyone's looking for heaven. Everyone's looking for the answer, including this woman. But it's to be found in Messiah. And there she is, face to face with him. A little while ago, verse 9, she saw a Jew. A little later, verse 19, she saw a prophet. But now she's face to face with the Christ, the one who gives living water. And it's decision time. Verse 27, at this point his disciples came and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city. Why did she leave her water pot? Maybe she's already found cool, cool water. Whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. Well, point number two. Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. Now, where did this woman go wrong? What was her sin? Verse 17. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you have well said I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. So was her sin a string of failed relationships? Was it having a sexual relationship with bloke number six, outside of marriage? Was her sin the breaking of commandment number seven, you shall not commit adultery? Was that her sin? Well, only partly. There's more going on here. What's the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. But what's she done? Has she filled her life with God? No, she's filled her life with men. Has she centered her life on God? No, she's centered her life on romance, relationships, sex. Well, somebody's thinking, well, what's wrong with romance, relationships, sex? Nothing's wrong with them. They're good. They're wonderfully good. They're God's good gifts. But what she's done is to turn these good things into an ultimate thing. To fill that space that's meant for God with something less. To worship the creature rather than the creator. To replace the true God with other gods. And of course it doesn't work. It can't work. 5 plus 1 tells you it doesn't work. Whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Look at her reaction. She said to her, go call your husband and come here. The woman said, I have no husband. Ouch. Why is she so private? Why is she so offended by that question? What's she hiding? Well, the fact is, her life is a mess, isn't it? Why? Because her gods have let her down. Her soul has been made by God, for God, and it can be satisfied with nothing less. And therefore these other gods, the gods of romance, relationships, sex, they can only let her down. They can't take the place of God, can they? That's why she's so touchy about it. That's why it's such a painful subject. These other gods that she's filled her life with, they're no gods at all. They're false gods. And they've left her empty and hurt and insecure and guilty and dirty. And they've also left her addicted. Because you see, when one relationship fails, what does she do? She goes on to the next relationship. She hopes that this time it's going to be different. This time the God will work. But 5 plus 1 tells you it doesn't work. Her life is still empty. She's still thirsty. Because whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Now, my friend, what of you? Do you see what's going on here? Sin is doing bad things. But it's not just doing bad things. Sin is also worshipping good things. It's taking good things and making them into gods. It's taking God's good gifts and giving them the place that alone belongs to God. It's taking something good that He has made and is a gift and turning it into something ultimate and worshipping it. That's what sin is. It's the worshipping of good things. In the words of Paul, it is to worship and serve the creature, or that which has been created, rather than the Creator. Sin is not just doing bad things. It's not just breaking the rules. Sin is taking good things and turning them into ultimate things. So, my friend, what have you? What have you turned to? With what have you filled that God-shaped hole in your life? Have you served other gods? What are the things that have taken the place of God Himself? Is it success? And so what do? You pursue success. It becomes a god. And what happens? You work harder and harder and harder, but you're still not satisfied. Leaves you ragged, torn, broken. And then what happens when things don't go right or you lose your job? Your gods abandon you. And you feel insecure. Whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Is it children? We can make gods of our children. And the efforts we go to. Because if your children don't turn out well, you'll feel a failure. And when your children are unhappy, you're racked with guilt. And when things go wrong with your children, you blame yourself. And when they leave home, your life feels empty. Whoever drinks this water will thirst again. You see, sin is making good things into ultimate things. Is it excitement, pleasure, fun? And what happens? You have to keep on repeating it, don't you? Because it doesn't satisfy. It can't satisfy. And what happens when you pursue excitement and pleasure and fun? You become addicted to it because it never lasts. So you have to keep on repeating it and repeating it and repeating it. And you have to keep on then reinventing it. And it has to become a bigger thrill and a greater thrill. And you go down a particular path and a particular line. And you find yourself going back and back and back again because whoever drinks this water will thirst again. And you can say that for anything, can't you? Maybe your God is music. And you love your music, but what happens when the music's over? What happens when you get tired of that particular music? You've got to go in search of other music. Kurt Cobain, he was lead singer of Nirvana. And you could say he had everything. He was young, he was gifted, he was intelligent, popular, he was rich, successful. He had a wife and daughter. He had everything. And then he committed suicide. What did he say? The world is not enough. Because whoever drinks this water will thirst again. My friend, you've got to understand this. The chambers of your soul are massive. They are so much bigger than you realize. Because God has made your soul. He has made it with the capacity to enjoy Him, to love Him, to obey Him, to serve Him. The capacity of your soul is massive. It can therefore be filled, it therefore cannot be filled with anything less than God. And we take these lesser things and we pack them inside and we'll say, that'll do it, that'll do it. But whoever drinks this water will thirst again. We don't realize the mastery with which God has made us. The awesome capacity of these souls that will live forever. They have been made to drink deep of God Himself. And we fill them with these other things. You shall have no other gods before me. Augustine wrote this, he said, Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. In the words of Jesus, whoever drinks this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. And so we come to our final point. It's an invitation to drink. We leave this scene for some of the last words of the Bible. If you have a Bible, you might like to turn to Revelation chapter 22 and verse 17. It's the last book of the Bible, so it'll be right at the end of the Bible if you're using one of the church Bibles. I'm sorry, I haven't got the page number. But Revelation chapter 22 is the last chapter of the last book of the Bible. And verse 17. These are almost the last words which God wants us to hear. 22, verse 17. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And let him who thirsts come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. Says Jesus, are you thirsty? Are you? Are you looking for everlasting satisfaction? Do you want to experience the very life of God Himself? Then come and take the water of life freely. And you'll never thirst again. Cool, cool water. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. God's Spirit in this message, He says to you, come. And the bride, the church of Jesus Christ, the local expression of this bride, the believers here, we say to you, come. And the woman at the well, she says, come. What does she do? She says to those around her, she can't even stop herself from saying it, come see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? She says, come and see him. Come and meet him. Come. And let him who hears say, come. Yes, as God passes invitation on to everybody you meet. Don't just pass them by. Invite them, because this is good news, the most wonderful news of all. And let him who thirsts come, and whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. My friend, I want you to see the warmth of this invitation. What does God say? He says, come. What do people say? They say, come to my house, don't they? Come to my wedding. Come to my party. Come. It's an invitation that's so warm, isn't it? God is being so warm. He's spreading his hands and he says, come. There's nothing threatening in the invitation, is it? It's warm. It's friendly. It's welcoming. And the urgency of the invitation. Three times we read this word, come. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And let him who thirsts, come. That's urgent, isn't it? If you want someone to come along, you don't just say it once. You say, come on, come, come. Because God sees us and he sees us dying. We're dying of thirst. But he says, here's living water. And I'm not taking no for an answer. So come, come, come. And the generosity of the invitation. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. It's free. You may drink the water of life freely. It says, God, come just as you are. Isn't that wonderful? Are you looking for everlasting satisfaction? And says, God, it's free to all who will come. It's free. Don't put your hand in your pocket looking for change or got to do something. It's free. Take it freely. That's the invitation. And the wideness of the invitation. Verse 17, and let him who thirsts come. So the only qualification you need, says God, is that you're thirsty. So are you thirsty? Well, then you're qualified to come, aren't you? Are you thirsty? Then says God, I'm speaking to you. Come. and drink. Before I was converted, I remember being so thirsty. Didn't know that's what it was. I just knew that there's got to be something out there. And when you're thirsty, you drink anything, don't you? Drink salty water, just makes you thirstier. And I was desperate. Desperate. I could think of nothing else. And then they spoke to me of Jesus. As the Bible was open, I saw something of who he is. And as they explained, I understood that he'd gone to a cross to die the punishing death I deserved to die, and that he'd done it for me. And I heard the voice of Jesus, the voice to a thirsty, dying man. And he said, come, come. I don't remember repenting. I don't remember believing. I didn't pray any special prayer or say the right words. I don't remember feeling really bad about my sin or the state that I was in. I just remember being so thirsty. And that was the only qualification I needed. If you're thirsty, he says, come. I heard the voice of Jesus, and I came to him, and I found living water. Let him who thirsts come. So why are you thirsty? Maybe you're saying to me, I can't believe all this stuff. Well, come and he'll give you faith to believe. Maybe you say, well, I don't know if I can repent of my sins and all this stuff you're talking about. Come to him and he'll give you repentance. Don't try and find these things before you come to him. Come to him. He'll give you everything you need. That's why the only qualification you need is that you're thirsty. So come, let him who thirsts come. Can you understand that? Can you understand that? Then you can come. And we look at the love that's in the invitation. Isn't this a loving, loving invitation? God says, these are almost my last words I'll speak to you in this book. So listen to them. And the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And whoever, and let him who thirsts come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. So it's God to everybody here. And whoever you meet, just pass on this invitation. God says, just come and drink. It's free. To dying souls, cool, cool water. But don't put it off. So lived all your life worshipping gods that are no gods, returning again and again and again. What was it for her? Another man, another man, another man. What's it is for you? What do you keep returning to? Of course, because water that can't satisfy. To have lived for those things when there is living water that satisfies your soul. And you see, those gods, in the end, they will drive you to despair. That's what happens to thirsty people, isn't it? Ultimately, they're driven to despair. Cyril Connolly went to Eton, Balliol College, Oxford, became an author, a journalist. At the end of his days, what did he do? He would suck the sheets on his bed and he would groan, poor Cyril, poor Cyril. It's what you're reduced to if you fill your life with other gods, which are no gods. And then what happens at the end? You die. But that's not the end, is it? Because at death, if you've served other gods, you enter the everlasting burnings, where there is not even a drop of water to cool a tormented tongue. My friend, how can you perish when here is living water? Hear the voice of Jesus as he calls out to you this night. If anyone thirsts, If anyone thirsts, is there anyone in this room who is thirsty? Jesus is speaking to you. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink.